Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Work with Purpose, a podcast about the Australian Public Service. My name's David Pembroke. Thanks for joining me. I begin today's podcast by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet today, the Ngunnawal people, and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and future, and acknowledge the ongoing contribution they make to the life of our city and this region. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the innovation at Work with Purpose keeps on coming. Today, I hand over the microphone to Jessica Irvine, the senior economics writer for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Jessica today is in conversation with Treasury Secretary and IPA ACT President Dr. Stephen Kennedy and the CEO of the Commonwealth Bank, Matt Common. Now, a key feature of Work with Purpose programs to date has been this link between the private and the public sector. And today we get a really great insight into how they have worked together in such a critical area of the management of the economy. It's a fascinating conversation, but also it's an important conversation, and I know you'll enjoy it.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Work with Purpose. I'm Jess Irvine, Senior Economics Writer at the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age newspapers, taking over the mic for this special get-together on the economic response to the coronavirus pandemic. And I'm really pleased to be able to bring to you listeners, two very special guests and two men who've been intimately involved in the public policy response to the pandemic, particularly from the economic point of view. You can't see this, but we're doing it in traditional coronavirus style via some sort of Zoom meeting. I'm in Sydney with Matt at the CBA headquarters. So that is Matt Common, who is the Chief Executive of CBA. Welcome to you. And joining us from Canberra, from a bunker somewhere, I believe, underneath the National Press Club, is Dr. Stephen Kennedy, of course, the Head of Treasury. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Jess.
So, Stephen, I'm going to start with you. It's actually a year this month since you took over at Treasury, and what a year it's been for you. I'm going to ask you both, but here's a quick fire question. If you had to summarise your 2020 in one word, what would that word be?
Well, the first word that comes to mind is busy, Jess, but it's not a very interesting word. Adaptive, I suppose. It's been a year where we've just had to adapt to the circumstances that have turned up in front of us constantly throughout the year. So I'd say adaptive, but when anyone asks me or anyone at Treasury, how's the year been? We normally say busy. So I've given you two. There's a good start.
That's all right. I was going to say swear words are allowed, but that's better if not. And how does it compare? Because I'm thinking of your career history. You were right there at the forefront of the GFC response as well. Have you had sort of flashbacks to that era when you were in Kevin Rudd's office and designing those sort of stimulus packages?
I have. It has been just as busy. The thing that's been really different this year is how long it's been busy for and how long we've had to adapt to the circumstances. A really big difference between the GFC response and the response to COVID-19 was with the GFC, we could see a few things emerging and then it came quickly and we responded through September, October, November, then a pause, and then we responded again, the government of the day responded again in February. And then it was very much about implementation. The pandemic is just a constant sort of uncertainty, unknown scenarios, if you like. So it's quite different. It starts faster than the GFC, much faster than the GFC, which perhaps we'll talk about in the podcast. And then it just keeps going. So we're running up to a budget on the 6th of October and we're still responding. And of course, we can all see circumstances in Victoria unfolding and on a positive track by the look of things. But quite different. It's had some similarities starting, Jess, but it has stayed with us. A really remarkable year, unique.
We're definitely going to get into some of the entrails of that, don't you worry. Matt, for yourself, do you have a word? Because I'm thinking of the context that you've come to this. You've had about 2.5 years now at the head of CBA, and of course during that time you've had a banking royal commission, you've had a few things on. How has the coronavirus sort of stretched and challenged you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first word that came into my mind when you just asked about it was COVID. I'd say a combination, like Stephen, busy, challenging, probably highly uncertain as well at the moment, really, over the last few months. And even the year itself, if you think about 2020, you're coming into the start of the year, very difficult drought. Lots of regions were really suffering. Then we have horrendous bushfires. And of course, that, quite rightly, really dominates the start of the year. I think from our customer perspective, obviously from a political perspective as well, and there's a lot of effort, you know, in responding to that. And then a couple of months later, we move into COVID. And as Stephen said, it escalated very, very quickly in that first quarter. And then since then, there's been sort of, I think, very good constructive work done across business and industry responding. So, I mean, some of the things that Stephen's team have put together through the federal government, we've never seen a response of that sort of scale. And then we've gone through these, you know, periods where the health situation looked like it was really under control. Clearly, there's been some issues in Victoria. And so I think for most people, it's been a very uncertain year, and that really weighs on, I think, our people, our customers. You can see that come through very clearly in terms of consumer and business confidence as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned the sort of discussions that you have at a government level, and I thought I would just contextualise for listeners why it's interesting to have you both together, because that's the question I asked. I was like, why are we doing a double header interview with these two? And I'm told that you guys just happen to get along pretty well, that you have been in quite regular contact as this sort of was unfolding, sort of to the level of, you know, your friendly and your text message. I was wondering if either of you can remember how you first met. Has your involvement just been since this crisis?
Yeah, I mean, look, the Treasury Department before Stephen took it over, at least from my perspective, there'd always be good dialogue between the banking system. And so typically if I'd go to Canberra or I'd meet Stephen's sort of predecessor, and come to the ABA, and so it had a bit to do with, Phil Gagens when he was in that role before he went into PM&C. I think what's been really different this year, which because of the scale of the challenges as well, I think some of the ways that both between, industry and policy areas have worked really closely. And we've certainly tried to provide any assistance that we can. And I think one of the advantages of the banking system for people like Stephen is we've got, hopefully high quality and high velocity data. So we've tried to sort of open that up. We've had a number of conversations in different areas. And so I think it's really helped that, overall the Australian sort of business community is not that large. And so, if you can sort of tie in, and I don't understand government as well, but I've seen up close a lot more this year about what goes on and how different areas, work together between Treasury and the Treasurer's office, across the different states. And it's just been, a scale of different policy decisions that have been required at speeds. And having seen how quickly people have had to respond to that, you have a lot of empathy for, I didn't understand the welfare system particularly well before this year, but as I've seen some of the changes required, we get to see what it's like to put through significant change and big changes to technology and processes. So I think hopefully on all sides, it's really developed, a good rapport, but also just a much better understanding of our various businesses and also how we can help. And I think that's been the key. I've seen so many examples of people just genuinely wanting to help, because it's just not a situation that there's an easy solution for any business, for any government policymaker either.
Yeah, and Stephen, for you, is it a situation where you're just actually able to call up Matt on the phone and say, I need some data on household spending, or how does that relationship work at your end?
Well, early on, Matt offered to share data with us, as actually have a couple of other banks and other parties, and we took him up on that offer, and it's been fantastic, because it's another difference with the GFC, Jess, that the use of real-time data has been especially valuable through this period. The ABS has also actually really stepped up to the plate with its use of the payroll data as well. So the use of real-time data from businesses, from the banks, other businesses, we set up a business liaison unit very early on that is more about developing policy issues, but it was a way of also about hearing very early on from business about how things are unfolding. Matt can see in his data how our policies are running through his customers. And it's really valuable for us to see how the welfare payments are flowing through, how they're being spent. A really important input, because this is a real-time, uncertain, adaptive period. In terms of his meeting, not surprisingly, Matt had a high reputation before I met him, and a couple of people had suggested, I'm not going to name them all, but, you know, people who are really good to talk to, about talk through issues, who take a really genuine interest in public policy. Matt was one of those people, and as you said, we clicked. Certainly very early on, it was very useful to call people like Matt and just seek a view about how things were going on the ground, really, Jess, because of how rapidly, which we'll come to, how rapidly things move through March. But Australia is still a relatively small place in your capacity to get out and talk to people. And it's sort of one of the things I've tried to bring to Treasury. There's so much good business intelligence. We always understand business needs to pursue its interests, but its capacity to understand how our policies are unfolding is also a very valuable input.
So have you got a WhatsApp group?
No. No, what's WhatsApp? What's...
There's always
I'm just joking.
Okay. We can set one up. After this. All right. So let's go to March. I wrote myself a little timeline because things happen fast in March. I thought I would just do the quick summary in case we've all got post-traumatic stress disorder and we can't remember what actually happened in March. It was the Reserve Bank who got out first on March 4 with a rate cut. On March 12, we had $17 billion in cash handouts and small business support. March 13, the next day, Scott Morrison restricted gatherings to no more than 500 people. March 19, we officially shut the borders. March 20, the next day, we had another rate cut, quantitative easing, and that's the day that the ABA, the Bankers Association, announced loan deferrals. March 22, $66 billion of stimulus, including that boost to JobSeeker. March 22, the same day, the evening of that day, after a national cabinet meeting, Scott Morrison shut pubs and gyms. And then March 30, we turned around and we produced the biggest single policy in Australian policymaking history, that of JobKeeper, the JobKeeper payment. So what a whirlwind it was. And I wanted to ask both of you this question, but Stephen first. What do you have a defining moment where you sort of looked at this and thought, this is very serious. We're going to have to pull out the guns. Was there something that you saw that really scared you?
My defining moment was back in February, because as Matt said, we had a really rapid start to the year. I really timed this year from the 2nd of January, which was when I cancelled my leave for January to work through on the bushfires, when the government was developing its $2 billion response to the bushfires, a cancelled leave, and we just had a lot of cabinet meetings and national security cabinet meetings through that period. And then as we tracked through January into February and we began to think about the pandemic as it was unfolding in China, my key timing point was I was asked by, in one of those meetings, about a paper I wrote in 2006 about pandemics, the macroeconomic impacts of pandemics. And I remember saying to that person, because that person said, oh, you know, is that going to guide what we're going to do? And I said to that person, I hope not, because that paper was about a very serious pandemic, the type of pandemic that's unfolded. And back in February, we were still thinking maybe this will be a SARS-like, maybe this will be contained in China. But it was at that point, I suppose, in my mind, I actually went back and read the paper again, because I wrote it a long time ago, 2006, and started to think, if this goes, you know, big, if this goes everywhere, what's this going to look like? And so that really switched it on for me. And then that in that March period, the first stimulus package is really a package that's responding to a very large international shock. And the next two are about a very large international shock with a domestic shock now very significantly rolling over the top. And what I had in my mind, Jess, in those early phases was, yes, it was going to be really uncertain. It was going to be really unclear about how things would unfold. And so whatever we began to design after the first package had to operate like a stabilizer, had to operate as if it would respond to any circumstance that arose. And so that's why JobSeeker and JobKeeper are demand-driven programs, because they will rise and fall with the extent of the shock that we're facing, rather than being, unlike the GFC, where we see a shock and then we calibrate a shock, 1% of GDP, or shall we do another 2% of GDP? As Matt said, we're in such uncertainty. We need to put in mechanisms that just that really will stabilise society and the economy. And it was a very quick clip, as you read out through March. I remember seeing Matt at our offices, I think he called in, with some colleagues in March, and I do remember saying to him, "This is going really fast," and he agreed, and it did.
Matt, how about for you? When was the sort of point where you thought this is actually going to require us to do this unprecedented sort of loan deferrals and all the things that you've had to do?
Yeah, look, I mean, as Stephen said, it clearly escalated very rapidly in March. I think in that week, the week of the second RBA rate cut, I think there were a number of us together with the governor. I think Stephen was on a video conference. I think the governor opened up with words along the lines of, "This is a national emergency." I think it was in that week. That was before JobKeeper, but it was the week of the second RBA rate cut, huge numbers of, we were starting to sort of then process deferrals. So that definitely stood out to me.
That's the private sort of hookup between policymakers.
Yeah, there's the gravity of the moment with some of the banks as well about the sorts of things. And I think, as you can imagine, the regulators, we're just trying to work out, what things we're going to put in place. And they're also wanting to make sure the banking system is going to continue to support the economy. And then the meeting that Stephen's referring to, which he very kindly, we went up to the Treasury offices and had a few ideas for novices who know very little about the welfare system, because we're also just trying to sort of glean anything we could internationally and, what about this or what about that? And, as Stephen patiently explained about, the constraints that you're working within as well. And I think what really impressed me during that period and since is, it takes a lot to make big policy decisions very quickly and to move away from, even between those different packages. There was so much that happened in that time. It was an international demand shock. Then we were moving into a very, substantial set of containment measures that were here. And that's, it's not easy to roll out something of that significance. I mean, the scale of the measures that were put in place, that combination, particularly of, JobKeeper and JobSeeker, it's not easy for a government of the day to do that, nor the policymakers. So let's Stephen talk about the exact timeline, but it was very compressed to try and get that from scratch, and you could see how much effort it would take from the ATO and others just to technically go and implement it. And a lot of, as I said earlier, empathy for how hard it is to build something like that from scratch, when you're really just in uncharted territories. And you can look at a lot of the international schemes, and one of the considerations was, well, that sort of looks good on paper, but we'll just never operationalize it. It just takes too long. So you've got to get something you can actually implement really quickly. And as you remember, it was basically the end of March and it was sort of the end of April for JobKeeper to really kick off, which is an incredibly short, implementation timeframe.
Yeah, Stephen, I'd love to know, can you sort of remember whose idea was JobKeeper? Like, who was it? Was it Treasury? Was it the government that said, we've really got to just have a massive wage subsidy program, we've got to staple people to jobs? Who was the first person to really drive that?
In the Treasury itself, the two people who were giving the most consideration to it were Jenny Wilkinson and Mark Cully. Jenny's the former head of the Parliamentary Budget Office, now a deputy there, and Mark Cully is one of our senior executives. I had people calling me about doing a wage subsidy too, Jess. There had been talk about doing a wage subsidy early on, particularly because the UK model had come out, the furloughed scheme, so where you pay for people who've been stood down. So I can't remember a specific thing, but we had internal people thinking about it. Certainly the ministers and their officers were interested in thinking about it because they could see it unfolding, and it was In some ways, Jess, it's an obvious area to think about. Almost every developed country has implemented one of these schemes. So in some sense, it's not novel, but we had to begin to think about how to implement it, because unlike, for example, in New Zealand, where they had an existing scheme they could scale, we had no existing arrangement on the JobKeeper side to scale. So Matt's picked up a really good point. The reason and not everyone has agreed with this, but the reason I was very focused on JobSeeker first was the system was there and we could scale it immediately. So that was the 550 supplement on the COVID side. And I also think that part of the argument I put at the time was not only does it stabilise the economy, but it stabilises the community because they understand effectively a basic social wage is thrust into the economy. Then we, as soon as that is done, we begin to think about do we do a wage subsidy over the top? And it's sort of readily apparent you're going to do something. And then we're thinking through what systems we have at the ATO and how to design. Some people would have wanted us to do a wage subsidy that tracked a person's wage up to a cap, which was a mechanism used in other countries, in Canada, for example. But we chose to advise the government, and they chose to accept in the end a flat payment based scheme, partly for speed, ability to align it with the job seeker arrangement. And then the second thing was, apart from the obvious benefits of attaching people to their employer, the JobKeeper piece, was we had to assist Department of Human Services in being able to make this payment to all these people who would no longer be receiving a payment, because JobSeeker goes from about 800,000 to 1.6 million, more than 2 million when you include other cases. Their systems were very stretched. So we have two really powerful systems in the Commonwealth, the tax system and the social security system. We used one. And JobKeeper is not just a wage subsidy, it's actually an income payment as well. So if you're stood down and you're not working at all, it's basically another way of getting an income payment paid through the tax system, paid through an employer. So it sort of works on a few different levels, and that enables us to, it just puts a whole platform underneath the whole economy at very uncertain times and stabilises it. So the last thing I'd say is the other benefit we had by being slightly behind a couple of other countries that went out early with their wage subsidy schemes was we could see what they do. And I wasn't sure. I think the UK system has worked well, but I was very unsure, to be quite honest, and not really in favour of just a scheme that focused only on stood-down employees, on what they call furloughed employees. I wanted a scheme that also assisted a business for people in employment and continue to work, that played that role. And that's our scheme. In the end, looked more like the New Zealand scheme, which did both those things.
Yeah. And how do you feel? You know, we chose that flat payment. That meant that some people actually got a pay rise, sort of, if they were casual or part-time employees. How do you think it stands the test of time? If you could go back, is there anything that you would have designed differently?
Well, since I was so involved in the design, you're probably asking the wrong person, because you're always perhaps going to speak in favour of it. We had to think about how it would interact with the social security system. If we had done a split payment in those days, then we would have had people being able to be on JobKeeper and apply for JobSeeker, Jess. And one of the things we wanted to do, in a sense, was relieve the job seeker system and keep as many people over on the job keeper system as we could. And so that's the flat payment also assisted that, and it goes with that mechanism of putting effectively a flat low social wage across the whole economy. And the last bit was, this wasn't going to be unhelpful towards aggregate demand. This was typically people who are going to spend most of the cash that you're going to pass through. And I think that's been true. We've seen that, I think, Matt, in a lot of the data of some of those recipients. They've really just pushed that money back through the economy, Jess. And while we had a very significant fall in the June quarter, I think it's been a very useful aggregate demand story. As the program goes on, Jess, then it's reasonable to think about adjustments. But in the early days, I was quite happy with the flat payment because it was really a trade-off between administrative efficiency, aggregate demand, confidence in the community that people were well paid. And yes, some money would spill at the corners. But I think if you spend a lot of time trying to track down that type of exceptional case, then you'll be too late in delivering the policy response.
Yeah, I think overall the time frame was so critical for implementation. And when you're implementing something like that, as Stephen said, basically from scratch, and you're doing it in a matter of days, it's not like the imperfections weren't known. There was always going to be some overpayment. There was never going to be, you can't design anything in that sort of time frame and try to get all of the, the perfect implementation that you would otherwise like. And so I guess at the margin, you look back at that, and as Stephen said, at least as we can see the data that flow through our accounts, it's very minor in the grand scheme of what it's cost the government and the country to try and put that sort of support system in place. Some of the imperfections are relatively minor, and ultimately it gets recycled back into the economy.
Yeah, and before we move on from JobSeeker, Stephen, how did it feel when scurrilous members of the media interpreted the recalculation of the modelling such that the scheme would cost $60 billion less than expected? And you had all the headlines about the biggest bungle, the biggest, whatever we were calling, mistake, error, worst mistake in history. I mean, how did that feel when we responded like that?
Not great. I didn't have any trouble at all with the original costing. It because effectively, very quickly, the costing was based on a lockdown scenario, a sort of French equivalent lockdown style scenario. The sort of scenario that has seen in some countries their GDP fall by 20%, as much as 20%. In our case, it was only 7%. So we advised the government around that type of scenario because as we put that scheme down in right at the end of March and the caseload was running in such a way and the community concern was such that we thought we were drifting towards that. And, of course, New Zealand had already moved into that type of arrangement. New Zealand ended up with, I think, about 62% of their labour force on their wage subsidy scheme. We got about half of that. There are some differences in scope. But roughly speaking, if we'd shut down in a similar way, then our original costing would have flowed through, to be quite honest, at roughly the right level. But that's, it's taking me a few seconds to explain that story to you. And so it's hard to get that type of piece out and explain how that unfolded. So, I didn't feel good because obviously that's a Treasury responsibility to do that costing, advise the government for the government to make it public. And I thought about should I have advised a range or done it differently. Colleagues advised me not to worry about it. What did they say? It's fish and chips or something or other. The story will come and go. But of course, I thought a bit about the reputation of the institution because one doesn't want, as much as one can, one doesn't want to damage the reputation of the institution. But I was quite happy with the policy. And then, as it turns out, the government has chose to extend it and we've had a second shutdown and we're now heading up towards over $100 billion in its cost. So perhaps, Jess, upon reflection, I should have been better in my communication around this, as Matt said, the sheer uncertainty about how these things would cost, how they would wax and wane with the circumstances as they unfolded.
I haven't heard the $100 billion figure again. Is that something that has been released or is that what we're going to be updated, I guess?
I think in Jeffu, we went up $15 billion. It's because of the extension. Admittedly, Jess, that's because it extends now and then also because it costs an additional amount of money. So, sorry, no, that makes 85. But, yes, I'll have to go and check my own costing. I thought that's what it was, but I think it's somewhere around that. Yeah, yeah.
So, Matt, what is happening for you during March? And I sort of see the two of your jobs. Stephen's got to keep people in jobs. Matt, you've got to keep people in their homes. When did it sort of become clear to you that you're going to have to give some people some breathing room on their loan payments? And who within the banking sector sort of really led that?
Yeah, well, the treasurer came to the ABA meeting, which must have been in, maybe that's around the 10th of March, and obviously things were starting to deteriorate, particularly globally, but we weren't at the deferral stage yet. I think that came around that sort of time frame that you said, around the 20th or so. And particularly in the lead up to that, there were, as the containment measures started to come down, obviously a lot of people were being stood down or losing their jobs. People were very distressed. And so in the lead up to that, both at the ABA level, so a number of basic, which is the bank CEOs with appropriate legal support, because not easy to get bank CEOs to be discussing topics. You need, understandably, competition approval to do so, and with the regulator, so particularly APRA. So there were a couple of iterations with that directly with the treasurer, and then I think there was probably two or three conversations at the ABA council level, and then we agreed on a range or a package of measures, and they were announced. APRA made a subsequent announcement, and then you probably recall there was a lot of discussion nationally around what happens to rentals during that period at both a commercial level and a personal level. So then there was an extension on the repayment deferrals to basically go up to larger businesses, particularly commercial property, where effectively, there was an agreement reached on the rental space. So that was a lot of March. And then obviously seeing the significant support that was coming through from the federal government, seeing how that was all sort of playing through. So I think probably there to Easter, sort of where we see 9th, 10th of April, that was really probably the most substantial contraction in economic activity. And then we started to see a rebound, later that month and into May, and things were travelling along, all things considered, better than we'd expected, absent Victoria.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess looking forward now, it remains your job, Stephen, to keep people in jobs, and your job, Matt, to keep people in homes. We are sort of heading for this fiscal cliff with the generosity of the JobKeeper payment being scaled back. We've now got discussions with banks and their customers about the loan deferrals, which can't last forever, and those conversations are being had. So far, we've held up pretty well, and actually national accounts show that household income was up. How concerned are you, Stephen, about now if we're, I mean, I'm going to ask you to critique each other, and I presume, Matt, you'll have some thoughts about what Treasury needs to be doing to continue stimulating the economy. And for Stephen, how concerned are you about this idea of loan deferrals where you might, if this all starts to wash out, some people can't repay their loans, you do get those forced sales and you get a house price effect and a wealth effect. How concerned are you about that?
Well, it's definitely an issue that we'll need to watch carefully. We have to continue, Jess, to think about the nature of this our circumstance, or because it's not. We just had Victoria. It's not. It's the Victorian outbreak, and now coming back under control. There is a sense in which we all start to think, well, the shock has passed through, and now we begin to recover. And we can look around the rest of the world and watch other countries. Israel is a good example. Just recently, locked down their economies again. So we just have to remain nimble, if you like, and mindful that we continue to live with a pandemic for now. It's incredibly important that the health side of it works effectively. Obviously, a state like New South Wales has done very well, and We're not in a sort of any sort of set and forget. Okay, we're through the shock. It's all over. Let's just stimulate the economy and away we go. And I think the banking sector is going to have to think very carefully about that too, because some sectors may well be viable depending on how the health side of things unfold. But we're actually not through it. Matt will have to be thinking about his customers in Victoria versus other states and how their circumstances unfold. So, yeah, I think it's not that I'm sort of disagreeing with the kind of premise of your question, but the sort of novel nature of this shock remains, and any response has to be able to continue to adapt to that. That we are going to move towards some sort of normal, which is not even clear. It's not clear when a vaccine turns up, and even how widely it's developed and how behaviour changes thereafter. So we have to begin an adjustment to do some normalisation. I think the ABA and the banking sector more broadly has done a very good job at getting out and engaging those customers who can get back and begin their repayments. And I understand, Matt, quite a significant number of businesses have. For those sectors that remain very badly affected, it's going to have to be a very careful careful adjustment and almost some forbearance and a continued watching of circumstances, Jess, would be my perspective.
And Matt, how long can it go on for, though? Can you be the CEO of a bank and say people never have to repay their loans? Is it not inevitable that some people are going to have to be foreclosed on or be moved on from their loans?
Yeah, look, I mean, there's definitely going to be some very difficult circumstances. I think to go back to the start of your question, I think collectively what we've achieved is a cliff. We've avoided, sorry. So I think we've got now an orderly transition and that avoids a cliff, both at a fiscal level and from a banking perspective. I mean, secondly, one of the things that's really stood out is just how important, I mean, health policy probably is the most important economic policy in the country at the moment, and the interdependency between those two. So in terms of the health outcomes and how that plays out, clearly what happens in Victoria, what happens in borders, tourism, I mean, more than half our population growth comes from, you know, net overseas migration. That's a hugely important element of our prosperity going forward. So we've, like the federal government, tapering their support. We're moving a number of, you know, hopefully the majority of customers across the industry will be in a strong enough position to restart their repayments, which most people, their initial 6 months ends around the end of this month. And then we'll be trying to target more of the support to those who need it most. And we're getting more than 60% of requests for assistance at the moment are coming out of Victoria, which makes perfect sense. There's other industries which are disproportionately affected, and it's got, you know, it's completely outside of people's control, obviously, in some of the services sector, hospitality, tourism. So certainly not indefinitely, but the idea would be, and there's enough flexibility that we have within the financial system and with the regulators to at least provide, you know, up to another 4 months around repayment deferrals going into calendar 2021. But we also have to realistically assess every customer at an individual level and ensure that they will be in a position to restart. And if they're not, then there's no point just kicking that can down the road. And so, I mean, we are in a very important period. I think it's sort of felt like that every month since March. But I think, you know, this month is the lead into the end of the calendar year, and no doubt Stephen's very busy, you know, advising the federal government around the budget. And it's going to be, you know, probably the most important budget in living memory.
What are you hoping to see from Canberra in that budget?
Well, I think they will be very focused around job, job
tax
creation.
Cuts. Do you think tax cuts are
appropriate? Well, I suspect that may be on the agenda. I think the number one, two and three priority for Australia over the next few years is going to be job creation and trying to reduce unemployment. We're going to finish at unemployment rate somewhere in the order of 10%, depending on participation rate. That's a significant headwind, and also causes, you know, real impact socially. So a lot of focus, no doubt, at the federal level, and I think also has to go in at the state level to think about that.
And Stephen, what's in the budget?
Jess, I'll just get my prompts out and read it out for you.
Broadly, from an economic macro perspective, though, would it be responsible to continue having fiscal strategy set at a stimulatory? Because if you don't do anything more now, you've got fiscal strategy set to be contractionary with the withdrawal of these payments. How appropriate it is for us to meet that? What's going to be phased out with additional support? Is now the time to be turning off the taps?
Well, there's two parts to this. One is that monetary policy is accommodative, but it's not supporting in the same way that it did in the GFC or in other cycles. So there is more pressure on fiscal policy to support this economic recovery than in living memory. Possibly ever, really, because of where we are near the zero lower bound with interest rates. And an example that we've used with the Treasurer is that I think interest rates were cut, let's say, by around 4.5 percentage points in the GFC, and that's equivalent to about $100 billion of fiscal stimulus, roughly, after about a year. So there is going to be a need to continue to provide support for aggregate demand. And Matt is 100% right. The top three priorities of any budget at the moment are jobs. Jess, the only thing to think about with fiscal policy is that stopping it or tapering it and then delivering it in another way doesn't necessarily mean everything turns off. A really good example is we saw in the June quarter the household savings ratio rise to 18%, one of the highest household savings ratios we've seen. We've actually put an enormous amount of money into the pockets, into the balance sheets effectively of households and businesses. In some cases, it's just offsetting. In some cases, it's even more. But people are being very precautionary. Hopefully, if they're, as Matt said, they're confident around the health arrangements, they begin to spend. And so it's not just a cliff. The money will continue to flow out in a smoother way than what the fiscal estimates suggest. The other part is additional fiscal stimulus, it builds on top of. So the fiscal impact of spending is not to sort of raise something and then it falls back. It has an impact. It lifts the economy to our point, and then it's a question of whether you need more fiscal stimulus to continue to lift it. It's a little bit like when you hold interest rates at a lower level to keep them accommodative versus sort of taking money back out of the economy. So there's no doubt there's going to be more need for aggregate demand, but we also need to make sure every other form of policy, be it around credit provision, be it around dealing with businesses, the creation or even insolvency of businesses, every form of policy that helps the economy adjust to generate more jobs, not just money, has to be switched on as much as possible to generate as many jobs as possible.
And is it your view that we do need further fiscal stimulus given the lockdown in Melbourne and the situation, that there should be further fiscal stimulus on top of what's happened?
It's my view that we're going to need more support for aggregate demand in the period ahead.
And just quickly, tax cuts do support aggregate demand? That is one of the policy measures that would work?
Do you want me to get that sheet out with all the policy measures on it, Jess, and read it out for you?
Okay, thank you. All right, we are running out of time. We had some fantastic questions come in from the Future Leader Committee of the Institute of Public Administration in Australia, who has organised this podcast. One from Megan Aponte Payne from PM&C, which was about the use of modelling and how important that's been, and I think we have covered that. And a second question from Michael Sinise from PwC was about the impact of this crisis disproportionately hitting low-income workers and women. So just quickly, would you both sort of agree that we are sort of seeing that impact being felt by low-income people and women, and what, if anything, we should do specifically about that?
Well, very quickly, it's hitting young people particularly hard, or downturns do, and this one is hitting young people hard. We have actually seen quite significant recovery in women's employment, but it did hit women quite hard initially. So a lot of our focus as we think about this next phase of support is around the characteristics of young people and low-skill people who are most affected, partly because of the nature of the industries most affected. So I'd agree generally with the premise, and it is a focus for us.
And I presume, Matt, a focus for you in dealing with your customers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see it in terms of across different cohorts. It's definitely skewing to some of our younger customers. And I think Stephen's explanation is spot on. You can see some of the sectors that have been hardest hit tend to skew towards lower income, certainly high proportion of female participants in some of those services industries, hospitality, tourism. So clearly trying to restart parts of the economy are going to help there. But as part of that job creation and income inequality as well has been a real focus both for Australia but also globally. And arguably that's gotten worse over the last sort of 6 months. So I don't think that as an issue is going away anytime soon.
Look, I think you've had an interesting 2020, both of you, and I think it's going to be an interesting 2021. And I think we should definitely set up the WhatsApp group and have me in there. And Stephen, you can share what's in the budget and we can hash that out together. I've really enjoyed our conversation today. Thanks to both of you, and thanks to IPA for organising this opportunity for us to go over some of the really important machinations behind the public policy response to the coronavirus. And thank you to you both for joining me.
Pleasure, Jess. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Jess. Great to see you.
So there we have it. Work with Purpose with our guest host, Jess Irvine from The Age and Sydney Morning Herald, in conversation with the Commonwealth Bank CEO, Matt Comyn, and the Treasury Secretary, Dr. Stephen Kennedy. Work with Purpose is part of the GovComs podcast network. And if you are interested in discussions with experts from all over the world about the latest trends, tactics, and strategies in government communication, please type GovComs into the search function of your favourite podcast app, and it's sure to come up. With Work with Purpose, if you would like to leave a rating or a review for the program, please do that, because it does help us to be found. And if you do see the social media promotion for the program, please pass it along and share. Thanks again to IPA and to the Australian Public Service Commission for their ongoing support. That's it for now. We'll be back at the same time next week with another edition of Work with Purpose. But for the moment, it's bye for now.
Work with Purpose is a production of Content Group in partnership with the Institute of Public Administration Australia and with the support of the Australian Public Service Commission.